Bob Murphy Show, episode 13.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, we got a good one for you today. You know how Tom Woods always really wanted to be an economist deep down? Well, when it comes to me, I always wanted to be a stand-up comedian. And today's guest is just the guy to scratch that itch for me. It's Dave Smith. Many of you already know him, I'm sure. But for those who don't, Dave's official position, the reason he's on my podcast here is because he's the host of Part of the Problem, which is a podcast that he often has co-host Robbie the Fire on with him. And they talk about all manner of political events from a libertarian perspective. But Dave's, well, you say day job, night job, I don't know how you say that, but he's a stand-up comedian. So I want to be clear, Dave is not a libertarian first who happens to be funny. He is an actual professional comedian who happens to be libertarian. And so much of this episode is just going to be me asking him about that world. And so I hope you're as interested in that as I certainly am. But later on in the interview, we do turn towards politics, and I ask Dave, you know, how did he get into all this stuff about the Federal Reserve and all that stuff? So the stuff you probably hear in other places, but we do spend a bit of time just talking about the theory and the practice of stand-up comedy. Without further ado, here is my interview with Dave Smith. Welcome, Dave, and let me say I wanted to get a few interviews under my belt before I brought you on because I got a lot of questions about comedy and I wanted to make sure I didn't screw it up. So I'm really glad to have you here on the Bob Murphy Show.
Well, I'm very happy to be here. It's an honor, and I'm glad you got all of those amateurs out of the way
exactly,
so you could make room for me.
Yes.
These Tom Woods and Scott Hortons, whoever they are.
Yeah.
But I'll try to keep it as interesting. I don't know if I can top Gene Epstein's childhood.
Well, probably not. Yeah, for those who didn't listen to that one, because you're like, I don't care about this guy from Barron's. Gene just like starts letting out bombshells about his mom like 13 seconds into the interview. And I'm wondering, like, is this too hot for, Apple iTunes? Whoa. So, yeah.
I never felt like I had such a normal childhood until I listened to that episode.
And he was saying it so matter-of-factly, too. Like, yeah, everybody just, yeah, I got the FBI file on my mom. You know, that's, is that a hassle? Am I right? You know, so I'm glad to have you here. Now, as you know, Dave, because I know you listen to some of these other interviews, what I do when I have somebody who's somebody that the people in the audience are going to already have heard a lot from, I want to go into, this is sort of like the origin story. You know, you've got your superpowers and we want to know how did this happen? So can you just, you know, whatever detail you want to give, but just the background of, I mean, I know that you know, you talk about Ron Paul and how that got you, but I mean, even earlier, like at what point, for example, did you say, you know what, my job, I want to be a stand-up comedian. I have to do that. Or is that how it did hit you?
Well, I don't know. I never really, as like a child, had a thing like I want to be a stand-up comedian. To me, that just seemed impossible. That it wasn't like something that was achievable. It was like famous people do stand-up comedy, you know,
right.
Like Eddie Murphy does stand-up comedy. I can't just do stand-up comedy. I knew I was a huge comedy fan. I loved it. I was obsessed with every, every single Blockbuster video, which was like the thing when I was a teenager, I would get every single stand-up tape or DVD that they had. And I grew up on like Seinfeld and The Simpsons, and it was just, there was the 90s. I was a 90s kid, and it was like a great time for comedy.
Were you ever in a Saturday Night Live or not?
I loved Saturday Night Live. I remember I have like memories of maybe being in like the third or fourth grade and getting into fights with my mother because she wouldn't let me stay up to watch Saturday Night Live, or she would let me have like the first half hour of it or something like that. But that when I was a kid, it was to me what is still probably the greatest, most talented group of comedians ever assembled was the Saturday Night Live cast when I was a kid around that age, which was like, you know, Chris Farley, Adam Sandler, Mike Myers, and Dana Carvey were still on the show. Phil Hartman. Mm-hmm. They had like Chris Rock on the bench. It was just an incredible, incredible group of talented comedians.
Yeah, I remember those years. It seemed like it comes and goes in waves. And like my dad would think back to when it was Dan Aykroyd and that golden era. Mm-hmm. But then when I think you and I are closer, Nate. But it was. There was that period. I don't think we fully appreciate it, but I remember my younger brother and I, we used to do our impressions of Dana Carvey doing impressions of like George H.W. Bush, knock on that, and all that stuff. And it was
I loved it.
You took it for granted. And then later, there was just such a drought and it was like, no, you young people don't understand. Saturday Night Live used to be awesome.
And I remember because back then there wasn't like the internet. You didn't like hear these things ahead of time. I remember just they got rid of the whole cast in one season and they just turned it over. And I remember just putting on Saturday Night Live, like the first episode of the new season, being so excited to see Chris Farley and Adam Sandler, and everybody was gone. And I was just devastated. And I actually hated Will Ferrell for about three episodes because he was like the new guy that they were making the focus.
Right.
And I was like, this guy's not as good as Farley. And this is nonsense. Like, I can't get into this. And then eventually he just won me over because he was just so good.
It's funny you say that. I resisted. I'm talking years. It wasn't until some of his movies. It wasn't even his first. I adamantly, like when he would do that cheerleader routine, mm-hmm. I thought that was horrible. I was sitting there thinking, this is an abomination. I felt bad for him and the girl, like they were up there doing that. And then for whatever reason, there was some movie. I don't even remember which one it was, but it finally clicked. And I was like, okay, I get what he's doing. And this guy's pretty funny. And then once the floodgates opened after that point.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a similar thing.
All right. Well, then if there wasn't a light bulb moment, it wasn't that you said, oh, I have to do this because you just thought it was unattainable. So was there an open mic night or something? How'd that happen?
Well, what happened was I got a job working for this like promotion company that was promoting comedy clubs, and they took us out as a company to a comedy club, and I remember it was almost like this amazing thing, because I grew up in New York City, but I didn't really know comedy clubs were a thing. I mean, like, I knew that's where Jerry Seinfeld was telling his jokes in the openings of Seinfeld, but that was when it was really amazing to me to see that. It was these people who weren't like world famous people. They were just people who were comedians. And I remember seeing it right away and being like, this is the most incredible thing ever. And a friend of mine, Louis J. Gomez, mm-hmm. An amazing comedian, it's still one of my closest friends in the world. He worked for the company and then he started doing stand-up. And me and him became really good friends. And he ended up moving in with me. We became roommates. We're like our early 20s. And he had started doing comedy. So I would just come out with him all the time. And I was like, oh, this is just so great. It's so much fun. And he really convinced me to start. He was like, you're like one of the funniest people I've ever met. You should be doing this. And he convinced me. And then I got up at an open mic and I never stopped.
Okay. So that's interesting. So how did this work? You were friends with him and you saw him actually get up and do it and you realized this is possible?
Yeah, more or less. Okay. I mean, I started going to all of his shows with him because I thought it was so great. It was so much fun. And then he convinced me. It took me a while. It took him a few months of like really convincing me. And I had this ridiculous idea in my head where I was like, okay, I want to try doing stand-up comedy, but I got to really sit down and think this through so that I'll have really great material right away. Like, I want to come in just being a great comedian. Right. And so that was kind of my excuse for not starting for a little. Like, let me just really think this through and then I'll be really good already, which is ridiculous. Everybody is terrible when you start. That's just, it's impossible. You have to just get on stage and get used to that weird feeling. And eventually he was like, look, I'm going to do this open mic. You're coming with me. You're doing it. He really pushed me into it. And I was like, okay, fine. And I did it. And it did not go very good. But I remember getting like a couple chuckles and loving that feeling.
Right.
And then I got off stage. And as soon as I was off stage, I was like, I want to do that again. I think I can do better. Mm-hmm. And then I just kept going.
Do you remember what any of the jokes from that opening set were?
Oh, God.
Or is set even not even the right word? Because were you up there for 30 seconds or something? Or what?
Probably like 4 minutes or something like that.
Which is a long time if you're bombing.
Oh, man. It feels like an eternity if you're bombing. And let me tell you, the half hour before going up feels really long. But it was, oh, man, the jokes were so bad.
Did you get like half drunk to get yourself the confidence or not?
I definitely had a few drinks in me just to, ease the nerves.
Yeah. Because just where I'm thinking of is I was, you know, I'm a mild-mannered economist. And then the biggest thing I ever did musically was there was this group called Flyby Radio, and they were down in Auburn, Alabama, and they were all Austrian fans, the you know, the husband and wife team that were the core of that group. And they saw me at karaoke that I could sing and said, Bob, we're doing a concert during, you know, the week of Mises U. We'll bring you up. And I did Sweet Caroline. And I was so, I mean, there were, I don't know the number, but I'm not easily 800 people in the crowd. And I was going to go up in front of a lot, you know, there wasn't going to be the TV monitor giving me the lyrics. And I was really nervous. And I was just pounding beers beforehand, like just to have the confidence to get up. And I was terrible, but, you know, but it was, I got up and somebody asked me how that was. And I said, that was better than sex. I mean, that was just,
yeah.
So,
but there's something amazing, you know, it's like, even as you bring it up and I'm thinking about this stuff, there's something I almost miss about that, that I don't know what I would have to do today to recreate that feeling, but it used to be like for the first couple years of doing stand-up comedy, it used to be this thing where I'd be really nervous to go on stage. And then if it went good, I mean, yeah, like you described, like it was, it would, I would be high for the rest of the night off like, oh, I had a great set over at Stand-Up New York or at the Laugh Lounge, or so I had a great set over there. And now it's, there's almost something sad about the fact that I just, you know, no matter how good it goes, I can't recreate that now. It's just, this is kind of my job. It's what I do. I've done it a million times and I'm used to it. And then conversely, if I bombed, I mean, it would just destroy me.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I've heard somebody, geez, what, I think it might be Chris Rock, but I can't remember. Somebody saying like you're not really a comedian. You have to get over the fear. You have to bomb before you can really take risks and do things. Like you have to get over that fear of bombing. Does that ring true for you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I'll go a step further than that even and say that if you want to see how great a comedian is, I think you have to see him bomb. Like most people don't see that. You just see kind of like the special, you know, you see it when it's sold out with their audience and these are the jokes they've been working on for 2 years or something. And when you like are in the New York comedy scene or the LA scene or something like that, when you go around, if you watch Dave Attell bomb, that's when you see what a true comedic genius he is, like how he can handle that situation. And that's a big part of it, is that there'll be these things where once you get to a level where you're a professional comedian, there will always be things that don't work out. You flub a line or you don't get a laugh exactly where you think it's going to. And you have to not affect you. It's almost like you have to have so many bombs under your belt that there's nothing that could be thrown at you here that is going to throw you off your game.
Okay. So what do you mean when you say you got to see like a real pro bomb to understand it? Do you mean because they're able just to shake it off and move on and win the crowd back? Or what do you mean?
Yeah. Well, the fact that if you see a really green comedian eating it on stage, just having a really bad set, you see it rattle them.
Right.
You
right.
see it affect them. You see it like affect their soul. There's nothing quite like seeing a really green comedian bomb. I mean, it breaks them down as a person. Whereas you watch someone like Dave Attell, for the example, or Patrice O'Neill or Greg Giraldo, or some of the comedians who are just great comedians who are working when I first started, and they are completely unaffected by it. It's like they could have a joke that gets absolutely nothing, and then 2 seconds later, they're riffing off that and getting a big laugh from the crowd or whatever it is. It's just, or even if it the next thing doesn't get a big laugh, you just see them just go straight through it. Like they're unaffected by it. And that's, you need that. It's not even like, it's like, that's almost like a prerequisite to being a great comedian.
Okay. So do they make it seem as if that was all part of the plan and they knew that that wasn't going to get a laugh, but you know what? I had to lay the groundwork for this other line that really is the laugh line.
Sometimes they'll do it that way, or sometimes they'll just address that the crowd sucks, or sometimes they'll just address that they suck, or whatever it is. Like, everybody's got their own style with how they deal with it, but it's all about not deviating from who you are with it when that's thrown at you. And it's just, I don't know how to say it. It's beautiful to watch.
Yeah, I mean, there's something about that too. Like, I'm you know, really interested in debates, you know, like between intellectuals, obviously, because that's my genre or whatever. That's the kind of thing where I'd be participating. And you're right. There is something about, it's kind of like you haven't lost the debate unless you signal to the audience that you think you lost.
Yeah.
if that makes sense.
Yeah, and there's, by the way, there's something about Donald Trump who's right. really got that quality. Like I've brought it up many times, but it was one of the most amazing moments, even though it hurt my soul, when Rand Paul pointed out that China wasn't in the TPP, as Donald Trump was going off on this whole thing about how the TPP doesn't work because it doesn't address China's currency manipulation. And then Rand Paul goes, shouldn't someone point out that China's not in the TPP? And Donald Trump, just with no hesitation, he goes, Rand Paul, what are you at, like 1%?
Yeah.
And it gets like a reaction. And then you're like, oh my God, I think Donald Trump won that exchange. And, you know, it makes you realize that when you remember in 2012 when Rick Perry had that moment when he couldn't remember the three departments that and now you look back at it and I go, oh, the problem wasn't that he couldn't remember the three departments. The problem was that he went, oops, and then kind of like retracted into his own shell.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, that's the problem, is that you admitted defeat. You admitted it. That was the only problem. He could have said, you know, anything. If he was just Trumpian and unapologetic, he could have been like, the Department of Energy, Department of Education, and what's the other one? There's so many departments, I can't even remember the other one. Whatever, we're going to repeal a lot. We're going to, you know, abolish a lot of departments, believe me. Right. You know, and like he would have been fine. but it's just you can't admit defeat.
Yeah, and so I guess probably the underlying element there is confidence. That, I mean, that's like mm-hmm. so much in all kind of areas of life. You know, you're applying for a job or whatever, and yeah, your resume has to be good, but if you're not conveying to the people that you're sure you can do the job, they're not hiring you.
Well, yeah. And it's confidence and it's certainty, which you kind of have to have this, even if it's an illusion to some degree, you have to have this illusion of certainty. Otherwise, nobody's ever going to follow you. That's, you know, you naturally, whether you're in a debate setting, and by the way, I didn't mean to compare presidential debates to academic debates because they're nothing like that. But whether it's a debate.
But there is that element there. I mean, that's certainly.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. But whether it's a debate or the presidential circus or being a stand-up at a comedy club, you're the leader. Like everyone else is being quiet and listening to you. And you're the one who's supposed to lead them in this direction. And if a leader gets up and is kind of like, well, I don't really know, but maybe we'll do this. Then, you know, they're Gary Johnson and it's not going to work.
Exactly. We all need a little more Tom Woods in us. Like that's the
exactly. What I'm trying to say is that Tom Woods is an alpha that we all wish we could be like.
Oh, I know. No, I mean, for real, like it is funny how, I mean, it's partly, you know, like we have our crews and, you know, if Tom and I are going to address the crowd, you know, I kind of follow his cues. I'm not afraid to admit that because I mean, the man's a force of nature. So,
well, he is. I mean, Tom, I remember like, listening to Tom Woods' speeches early on in my libertarian days and just being blown away by them. It's funny because when you know Tom as a person, you know, obviously, you know him very well, and I've gotten to know him very well over the last few years, but he, you know, it really is like something comes out of that guy when he's publicly speaking, and he's really got a talent for it. It's the reason why I desperately wanted him to run for president. But he's not going to.
Yeah. And what's funny about that, too, is yeah, people would hit me up and want me to be his VP. And then sometimes when Tom was demurring, they'd say, OK, Bob, well, maybe you could be the president and he could be the vice president. And I would look at him and be like, you really think that would work? Tom would be my vice president. And they go, yeah, you're right. That wouldn't work. And they walk away.
But you also, you know, again, the problem you have, and again, I don't, it's a great quality in you. So I don't mean it as an insult at all.
Well, but good, because I jotted down beforehand the problems I'm going to explain to you about your character, but go ahead.
No, but I mean, just the problem for something like that is that you're almost too generous to your competitors. And you're too quick to like, be like, okay, well, this is actually oversimplifying things. And the point that they're making is more like this. And you're very kind to your opponents, whereas Tom just smashes people. And that's what more translates into the political realm. But by the way, it's a great quality in you. I'm not trashing you for it. It's just in terms of using the political system to promote freedom. The thing that Tom does is what's going to work with that.
You're right. Yeah. Trump doesn't say, now I respect Rand Paul and his opinion. He's done a lot, but let me mention on the TPP. That's not what he did.
No, you got to smash him.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess you're saying that, so that just to go back to your, you know, how did you fully get into it? So with the beginning few times you went up there, I mean, you said, oh yeah, I need material. I mean, how does that, are you just walking around and funny stuff occurs to you and you jot it? Like for me, you know, I have some funny Facebook status updates or and it will happen. Like I'll be in the store or something. So now it's gotten to the point where if something funny happens, I'll just mentally make a note or literally pull up and say, oh, I could make that into a funny tweet or something or an observation. Is that like the mode you have to be in if you're a professional stand-up comic, is just be open and receptive to funny stuff?
Yeah, I think particularly in the first few years, you're like desperate for material. So it's not that you find fun. Like, we all find funny things. Everybody has funny things happen to them throughout their day, or they say something funny, or someone else says something funny. It's just in your first few years of stand-up, you're kind of obsessively like, every time that happens, you go, oh, I could make a joke out of that, or I could turn this into a joke. Now, some people have different styles. Some people will like be able to go to a coffee shop and sit down and be like, I'm going to write comedy for 2 hours. I was never able to do that. To this day, I can never do things that way.
Do you know, like, in terms of famous comics, do you know, like, can you give us like, oh, so-and-so, that's his method? Or, like, do you know any of that?
I don't know. I know more of like my friends.
Okay.
And like what their methods are. I don't really know as much about like the formula or the method for household famous comedians, but I know that I know a lot of my friends who will do it that way, who like go out and write. But for me, I've always been more, and I think it's something about my personality and the way I am, but my thing would always be like that. I kind of have an idea and then I'll go explore it on stage and I'll just kind of start talking about it. And there's something about being put in the situation where I'm in front of a room of people that I'm trying to make laugh, where I'll find the words better than I could if I was sitting at home at a desk. Like, I'm just, it's like you just put these things into the language of comedy. And then it's almost like, in the same way that if you're a writer, if you're a good writer, which I am not at all, but for anybody out there who's knows how to write, it's kind of like you could have a thought, but then there's like the proper way to put it into a sentence, you know, like how someone would write a little bit differently from the way they would speak. Mm-hmm. It's almost like just a different way to put things. And when you're in front of people and you're supposed to be evoking this very specific reaction, you're supposed to be pulling laughter out of this group of people, there's just a way that it'll get presented. So I've had lots of times where I'm kind of thinking of something and I'm like, I don't really know if there's anything there. I don't know. And then I'll just be on stage and it's almost like I'll just bring it up. And then I find the words on stage. And then I'm like, okay, I got that joke. And then I can work it from there.
Okay. So yeah, that fascinates me. And so is it at the point where you're comfortable on stage? Like, because that's the thing, like you see any talented, like you watch Elton John or Billy Joel or Paul McCartney when they're up there, and they could be in front of a crowd of 30,000 people or whatever, and they're just having a good time. And, you know, and like it's not that the crowd's not there. No, the energy of the crowd feeds into it and that makes them perform, but they're not worried about making a mistake.
Yeah. Well, I think I absolutely. And, you know, so much of that is just about preparation and reps. Like they've just done it so many times. So if Billy Joel is playing at Madison Square Garden, it's like, yeah, well, this is the 70th time he's sold out Madison Square Garden in the last 3 years. You know, like this isn't, you know, if me or you were just thrown up there in Madison Square Garden, we'd be like, oh man, this is crazy. But so much of that is about like, you know, it's a mix of things. It's the reps. It's the fact that he's done it a lot of times. And the fact that he's really good at what he's doing and he knows his songs and he knows these people love his songs. Like if Bob Murphy on very short notice, they were like, hey, you got to go give a talk on Austrian Business Cycle in front of like 400 people. You know, you might start getting some thoughts together, but overall, I don't really think it's going to, you know, strike fear in your heart because you're right, like, well, yeah. I know this. This is what I do. Like, this is what I do. I know this.
And just to continue your analogy, what's funny, because I have done presentations like that and I do have some laugh lines built into it that I know work. And so I can say them with confidence because it's worked the last 8 times I've done it.
Right.
And so, yeah, I get you saying.
And then you're in this whole dynamic where you've got things that support it. So even if you have a line that you're like, okay, well, this gets a laugh and I know it gets a laugh, but even if this line doesn't get as big a laugh as it has gotten before, well, I'm about to make a really interesting point about this. And then I really know this. And if there's a question answer segment, I know I'll be able to answer the questions about this. However, if they just said, hey, tomorrow, same 400 people, you got to go do a lecture on some topic that you're not well versed in, it would probably make you a lot more nervous because you're like, oh, but I don't really know that. Oh my God, I got to cram. This could go bad. I don't know what the variables are or where this could go. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it just becomes, you just kind of get comfortable it's like anything. It's like just the way anybody on their first day at work are probably nervous about something. But when you've worked there for 10 years, you're like, this is what I do. This is normal. So that's what you see those guys having when they go play 30,000 people in some arena. That's what Elton John does.
Right.
That's just it.
Mm. Okay. Well, why don't I transition to this point? And I asked you to do some homework for this. I had asked you that you're going to give us a little mini lesson in stand-up comedy. And so you selected for our listeners a clip from George Carlin speaking on Muhammad Ali in the Vietnam War. And so why don't we go ahead and we'll play the clip first. And is that what we do, or do you need to set it up first? Do you want to give any context, or just we'll play it and then you'll...
Well, here's my first piece of context is that I realized how filthy so many of my favorite comedians are. Because when you first asked me to pick a joke, I ran through about 20 in my head and I were like, these are all very... very inappropriate. Like, yeah, I was like, I don't know if this is going to work. But then I was like, oh, let me find. And then for some reason, this joke just popped into my head and I was able to find it pretty quickly on YouTube. And it's from George Carlin, who is quite possibly the greatest comedian ever. I just love everything. I love so much that George Carlin would have like, he would take on really serious issues that you could tell he really cared about, but he never took himself too seriously. And he would have one joke that would be like this long thought out bit about the way our civilization is constructed and how we've lost our soul in modern society. And then his next bit would be about how hilarious farts are. And it would never even like seem out of place. It would just be like, this is all part of what he does. So anyway, this joke, which I thought would be particularly, you know, like I thought your audience would enjoy the content of it. But this is, I believe, 1971. And this is George Carlin talking about Muhammad Ali and when he dodged the draft and they suspended his boxing license.
Okay, folks, so here we'll take a listen.
And the big fight is coming up. Ali and Frazier, Muhammad Ali. I call him Muhammad Ali because that's what he wants. Oh, yeah, he's a big dude and he hits hard, you know. I'll call him what he wants. But it's good that he's being allowed to work again. As you know, he couldn't work for 3 years. Of course, he had a strange job beating people up. But that was his, you know, his right. He could have that job. Government wanted him to change jobs. Government wanted him to kill people. He thought it over and he said, no, that's where I draw the line. I'll beat him up, but I don't want to kill him. And the government told him, well, if you won't kill him, we won't let you beat him up. And it was all because he didn't want to go to Vietnam, and now we're getting out of Vietnam through Laos and Cambodia. That's got to be the long way. You got to go through China and Russia to get out that way. What are we going to tell them? We'll only be here a short time. Just looking for a trail. Well, maybe they'll go for it. I don't know.
All right, Dave. So there's the clip. Funny stuff. Now tell us more. What are we missing here? What's he doing? What's the genius behind this?
Well, so to me, there's a few elements about it that are this is why this to me is like comedy at its best, at its absolute highest level, is because he's diving into what is a very serious issue. And you don't, no matter what your opinion on the issue is, or if you just aren't that interested in it, you can still just laugh because it's undeniable how hilarious it is. Now, he's taking something that everybody's aware of in the culture. Everybody knew that Muhammad Ali didn't go fight in Vietnam and that he couldn't box for a few years. You know, this was the Vietnam War and it was the biggest boxer in the history of boxing. Everybody knows this story. But I bet he put it in a way that you've never thought of it in exactly those terms. And what he's doing is you can't even argue with him because he's calling things, instead of calling them by the name that they're given by society, like boxer or war, he's calling them by what they actually are, which is beating people up and killing people. And then he's able to just put it in the beautiful prose of comedy. And I just love every little beat where he just goes, even first when he says it's a strange job beating people up and just makes you think about boxing in a different way. Mm-hmm. And then he says the government came in and said they didn't want you to beat people up. They want you to kill people. And he said, no, that's where I draw the line. And that right there, that little moment of, no, that's where I draw the line. That's what I mean by how you put something in the language of comedy. I don't know exactly how to say it, but just saying it that way and pointing out that the government is this insane institution, and now the guy who beats people up for a living has become the reasonable one who's like, no, sorry, that's where I draw the line. And then to bring it back to, well, the government says, well, if you're not going to kill people, we won't let you beat them up. It's just such a hilarious way to look at it. And that is literally what they did to this man.
Right.
That's actually what the government did. And it's one of those things. This is the effect that comedy can have, where it's not going to take somebody and completely convert them. You know, it's not like I'm never going to be able to go do a comedy set and say someone, you know, went in a Bernie Sanders socialist and came out a Rothbardian ANCAP. Like, that's not, but you plant this little seed where it's hard to ignore the absurdity of the reality of what's going on. And I just love that. And I love the, I don't know. I figure for any, you know, for your audience, they would appreciate that as well, that there's just something so beautiful about showing you the reality that we all know, now making you look at it from a slightly different angle. And then it's so wordsmithed and like put perfectly that you're like, oh God, that's just, it's just perfect.
Well, and just to, you know, perhaps we're in the danger of overanalyzing, but you're right. Like I could imagine it occurring to me, for example, like, hey, that is kind of ironic that, you know, he beats people up for a living, but he doesn't want to go kill people. But I could imagine if I were like giving an economics lecture and I was going to make a joke based on that premise, I would do it all right away. Like I would just say, you know, you hear what happened to Muhammad Ali. Well, you know, the government said it's not enough to beat people up. You need to kill them or something. Ha ha. And then I'd get a chuckle. Whereas Carlin, like you said, he had like a multi-stage warming them up and like drawing them into the premise of the joke. And like, it just kept building on itself. Like he took that one idea and turned it into like, you know, 60 seconds of repeated bursts of laughter. So is that something you learn how to do?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like, if you're reading Shakespeare, it's like, you know, I could have maybe had the thought that like, whatever you call something, you know, it's kind of still the same thing. But I'm not, it wouldn't be put into like this beautiful language, right, the way Shakespeare would. And that's what Carlin's doing. Like, to me, that's like comedic Shakespeare. Like, it's just put into this perfect way where I'm going to lay out every level and I'm going to pull, like, just elicit this laughter from you. And it's, that stuff to me is just like beautiful to watch. I love watching real high level comedy.
And also, is it a thing? Because notice there, Carlin wasn't the narrator saying, apparently, where Muhammad Ali draws the line is it be, but instead he became Muhammad Ali for the joke and said, yeah, that's where I draw the, and that was funnier than if he had done it as the narrator.
Yeah. And just the way he says it, right, that makes it funnier that he owns that he says it as the first person. And then it's also just the way he kind of just matter of factly, like, it's not like, oh, I'm outraged. He's not like pushing some message on you. It's just Muhammad Ali, like, kind of casually being like, well, that's where I draw the line.
Right.
I'll beat him up, but I won't kill him. And it's just the funny is undeniable.
Yeah. And what's interesting too is, yeah, Carlin was my favorite comedian growing up too. But when I was younger, you know, I got into politics like via Rush Limbaugh and that route. And so there was a period where I loved, you know, Carlin's stuff about, you know, like parsing the airline's message about, you know, how to put your seatbelt on and all that. And, well, tell him Air Marshal Carlin said F you, you know, that kind of stuff. But I didn't like his political commentary. Like, I was for the first Gulf War and everything. And so when Carlin would rip on all that stuff, like, isn't it about time we started bombing brown people? I actually got mad. But I would tolerate it because I just thought he was so funny. I would wait for him to get off his political comment. And so now, of course, looking back, I can appreciate it much more since I'm far more in tune with his political views. But you're right. He did. I think he knew that. Like, and he would even deliberately say sometimes, you know, quite consciously, like, you know, a comeback and things that we all can appreciate. He talk about, you ever been looking at a fence and you see it, you know, and he knows he's like alienating some of his crowd if he stays too much on like why the system is evil. And he comes back and just does stuff about language or whatever, or
right,
just your visual illusions that everybody can appreciate.
Right. And, but one of the things that I like that, you know, it's like the comedian's job isn't necessarily, it's never going to be to convince you of their position, but if it's done right, he'll still make you laugh. Like, I could imagine somebody who adamantly supported the Vietnam War still, even if they were trying not to, cracking up at that joke. Because whether or not you support the war, the idea that someone who beats people up for a living was told he has to start killing people or we won't let you beat them up, is just hilarious. And that's one of the things that I love about comedy, is where you could make someone laugh who doesn't agree with you at all, because they have to at least give you, they have to at least grant you that, okay, that part is a little ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like I have to at least grant you that.
And that even if you were for the Vietnam War, you couldn't deny that it involved killing people.
Right. Right.
You know, so there was no getting around that. Whereas technically in there, Carlin, I mean, you knew his views overall, but strictly speaking in that one bit, Carlin didn't say, I oppose the Vietnam. Now, later when he was talking about the Ho Chi Minh Trail and everything, then you get the sense, okay, yeah, he's totally against it.
Yeah.
But up to that point, you're right. Somebody could have made the same joke who actually, you know, could say, geez, I don't know. There's, you know, that's foreign empires and I don't know about the Soviet Union and I don't know. I'm just a comedian. Somebody could have made that same joke just with those observations.
Sure. But I mean, I always like, that's the type of comedian I admire. And that's the type of stuff I always try to do where, like, you know, I know people have asked me things along the lines of like, you know, like there's so much to libertarian and Austrian economics and anarcho-capitalism. Like how are you able to, like, you know, approach that for in your comedy act and blah. And it's like, I don't approach any of that. None of that is really my job. All I'm going to make people do is just notice, at least in this one area, how absurd the state is or how absurd this way of thinking is. And once I get that, it's just like planting a seed. Like, okay, this, you have to at least admit this is hilariously ridiculous, whatever it may be.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess that's a question too I had for you. Is it, I think you said this, you were our guest, of course, on the Contra Cruise, and you had a breakout where you were just talking about comedy and whatever. And you said something like, I'm paraphrasing, but you know, you said something like, my job is to kill. And I get up there, you know, I don't care about politics. I have to be killing. And that's my, you know, number one job as a comedian. And sure, the political stuff. But it's not that you're using comedy as a way to spread libertarianism when you're actually doing stand-up. Like your job is, you're a comedian.
Right. I'm doing comedy to make people laugh. I happen to be a libertarian. And I'm, you know, as people who know me know, I'm like obsessed with this stuff. So it is deeply ingrained in my, like, who I am as a person now. So that's going to come out. But that's, there, nothing else is my job other than to kill, to make the whole room laugh. That's my job, to have people laughing so hard that, like, they can't get a sip of their drink down. That's the goal of being a comedian. That's what they paid money to come see at a comedy club. Now, if I can also, while I'm doing that, make something where, you know, like a good point was made, or, you know, like it gets toward, you know, something that I think is important, then that's great. To me, that's like, but all the comedians, to me, like the highest level, like even if it's like, whether it's South Park or George Carlin or The Simpsons or anything like that, you can't sacrifice one inch of funny to make your point. Otherwise, you're not doing your job as a comedian. So I think I think that's like that's where a lot of people, you know, I've gotten like you know, messages and emails and stuff from younger comics who are like doing open mics, and they're like, you know, like I really try to like when it, like, how do you talk about politics on stage? Every time I try to talk about politics, it just kind of comes off preachy and it's not really getting laughs. And my response is always like, well, then stop doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Stop doing it. Talk about something that gets laughs. Don't overthink it. When something really funny about politics comes to you, then talk about it. But always go for laughs first. This is how Trump destroyed so many like left-wing comedians who used to be funny, because they're so angry about him that they can't go for laughs first. They have to go to try to make their point. And it's just like, this isn't what comedy is supposed to be. Look, I never had any funny jokes about Ron Paul. I never had any jokes that involved him, because I was too emotionally attached to Ron Paul's campaigns. They meant too much to me. It was like it was like if I was going to talk about Ron Paul, it was too much like, no, this guy's telling the truth and everyone's treating him terribly. Like this is, there's nothing funny there. But when it was Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, it was easy for me to just make fun of it, because I had no dog in the fight. I didn't really care, and it was easy to just like make fun of both of them. There was just so much there. And I mean, you know, it was particularly easy because they were both just, you know, ridiculous.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's probably what, I mean, some of my favorite Jon Stewart bits on The Daily Show was when he was showing how Fox News was like shutting out Ron Paul.
Yeah.
And I think that's partly why he could do it, is because he wasn't angry about it. He was just pointing out like, isn't this kind of ridiculous? Whereas yeah, I think like if you or I were talking about that, we'd get real mad and like, I can't believe, you know,
yeah.
Which, you know, would ruin the comedic aspect of it.
That's, by the way, I'll always be grateful to Jon Stewart for that bit. It was the greatest thing I've ever seen. And I completely agree with you. I don't think a libertarian, the fact that everybody knew that Jon Stewart isn't particularly sympathetic to libertarianism made it 10 times more powerful. And it was just, no matter what side you were on, no matter whether you agreed with Ron Paul or disagreed with every one of his positions, you couldn't get over, you can't deny the funny of when they're playing that clip and they go, Rick Perry's in first, Mitt Romney in second, which pushes Bachman down to fourth. And he goes,
right.
Fourth behind who? Like, when did Ron Paul become the 13th floor in an elevator? So there was that stuff. But then you'll see, you know, stuff like Stephen Colbert, who used to be so funny.
Oh, yeah.
In that Colbert Report show that followed Jon Stewart. He was so funny, but he so hates Donald Trump that it's almost the dynamic you were talking about if we were talking about the media criticizing Ron Paul. Now he's got that. And it just, it breaks my heart to see, because it's like, oh, you're incapable of being funny when you're this angry.
Yeah, yeah. That, speaking of which, about the Jon Stewart, I admit objectively it wasn't as funny, but did you see when he ripped on Paul Krugman?
I don't remember this.
Oh, I'll send you that one. That's, you know, that has a special place in my heart, where Krugman gave some pushback on, you know, it was about the $1 trillion platinum coin. And Jon Stewart had a bit where he was saying how stupid that was. And Krugman, in his own, you know, blog or column or whatever, said, oh, this is just the, you know, the Daily Show writers being lazy and getting a cheap joke, when this is a serious economic, because Krugman was for the $1 trillion platinum coin.
Uh-huh.
And then Stewart just came back guns blazing and mocked him mercilessly in the next one. It was great. So I'll send you that.
Another one. Did you ever see, because I bet you would really love this, but did you ever see when he just destroyed that guy Kramer from CNBC?
I don't think so, no.
Okay, I'll have to send you that one. But it was, I mean, he just put this guy through the ringer and did this whole bit about basically Kramer was, it was right before the 2008 financial crisis, and Kramer had been pushing Bear Stearns.
Oh, okay.
For people to buy Bear Stearns stock, and Jon Stewart just rips him apart. It was beautiful.
Well, while we're still in the wake here of talking about Carlin, let me just mention, because this was something I didn't realize, that, yeah, I used to think that, oh, these guys just are magical, and they're just like, you could see a professional basketball player. And yes, there's a sense in which they're born with certain things, but also, yeah, the reason Larry Bird is so good is he practices more than you ever have, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
With Carlin, I went to see him a long time ago. It was like in the University of Michigan, I think. And, you know, so he's just speaking to a college crowd, and he actually at one point pulled out notes and read us a bit that he was working on, and it felt very stilted and just like he was phoning it in or whatever. And then I saw later he had an HBO special where he had that thing memorized.
Yeah.
And so I realized, oh, that's how he gets up to him speaking to a college crowd. You know, to me, that would have terrified me to speak to a crowd that big, but to him, we were nothing. And then he was just working out the material and, you know, not tripping over his words or whatever. He had to have the whole thing written out at first. And then later you see it when he's perfected it, you know, on the HBO special.
Yeah, well, that's kind of it's amazing to watch comedians. And when you're on the scene, you know, and doing the clubs every night, you see a lot of that, because you see people working out their stuff, and then you see it when it's a finished product. There's something interesting in the relationship between the comedian and the audience, where with comedy particularly, when you have an idea, you're kind of trapped in your own head, and you can think this is going to be really funny and get a huge reaction, but it's almost like you have to play with the audience for a while to see what points hit the biggest laughs, and then to kind of reframe things. And sometimes you have to discard things and just be like, yeah, I thought there was something there, but I just can't get that to work. But I remember seeing the thing that was really incredible to me was watching, you know, who now I guess we're not allowed to think is funny anymore, but Louis C.K.,
mm-hmm.
who was, of course, a comedic genius a year and a half ago and is now a lazy hack, according to like the Huffington Post or something. But you would watch him come around, and there'd be like right at the beginning when he was working at a new hour, and there'd be a few things that I was like, I don't even get what he's trying to, where he's trying to go with this. And then I'd see the special, you know, 6 months later, and it'd be like the funniest bit you've ever heard. And I was like, oh man, he really, so like some people really, you almost won't even understand where they're going. And then they work it every day for 6 months. And then all of a sudden it's just this perfect thing. But yeah, I mean, like there's something about stand-up where it's kind of presented as like, okay, this is off the top of my head, or I'm just up here. Hey, I'm just a guy with a microphone. Let's talk. But then when someone puts something out that is so beautifully, perfectly written and every single punch hits and every single tag like lines up perfectly, it's like, yeah, that it didn't just come out like that. Mm-hmm. Believe me, it started. There was a process involved before it became that perfect.
Yeah, I remember my friend was a drummer and he was showing me stuff on YouTube and he showed me this one amazing thing. You know, this guy going off on this solo for, you know, 2 minutes or whatever, and the orchestra's following the guy and everything. But it came off real improvisational. And I said something like, wow, that's amazing that those people are at that level that they can just anticipate what he's going to do. And he looked at me and he was like, my friend looks at me and he was just like, what are you kidding me? They had every second of that all planned out and they probably cracked, you know, and I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So no, they made it look like it was a jazz thing. We're just going to wing it. When no, that wasn't what happened in that particular clip.
But that's the reaction you're supposed to have, is this feeling of like, oh, they just did that. But in reality, it's like, oh no. I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into that.
So can I ask you, now I don't want to, we're not going to play the clip or anything because I want people to go watch your Libertas special, but the particular bit that everybody remembers, you know, that they say, oh my God, is the thing with the Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
So I'm going to force people. I'm not even going to put the clip, folks, up on YouTube, I want you to go buy the special and we'll have the links. This is BobMurphyShow.com/13 to, you know, because Dave needs to, you know, feed his kid. But on that one, for those who already saw it or whatever, I mean, just is that something like, you know, that's a thing where you had the idea and then you expanded it into a long thing that had several lines that would make people pee themselves. And like, did you, how like, were you testing that out and like, did the thing grow over time?
Yeah.
Okay.
It never, like when I first started doing it, I mean, I started doing it like the week after Nelson Mandela's funeral, where I just thought it was so funny. And I thought the whole thing was so funny. And I was just joking about it, about a guy, you know, being a sign language translator who got busted for doing fake sign language. There's been a few more of them since I put the special out. But so there was that, and I was playing around with it in clubs for a while. And then I kind of put the bit away and wasn't using it as much. And then when Trump came back, I kind of made the connection there. And then I brought it back and connected it to Donald Trump. So yeah, there was a whole like history of that bit, if you had seen it. In fact, I have some stuff that I'm not gonna put out, but I have some recordings of, like, you know, just like sets where I was working stuff out, where I have that bit like in its infancy. And that was one where I was actually watching a while back and I was like, oh, wow, that thing came a long way. It's weird. It's almost like it's like watching your like a child grow up,
sure,
or something.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that thing really developed.
Yeah. Like, again, without spoiling it too, but I mean, like the element of about the guy's father and stuff, was that in it from the beginning or is that something you added later?
No, that came later. That came later, like putting a whole backstory to it and kind of, you know, you're always thinking about what the next kind of like thing that you can tag onto it is.
And I imagine too that it's a kind of, well, so that's my question here. But when you have a thing like that, when I see comedians doing that and it's wonderful, or, you know, like Richard Pryor's got his famous thing about, you know, he's out there in Africa and he's looking at like the tigers and all the different animals and how they can outrun you. And it just occurred to me that, like, if the first couple of things that were supposed to be funny had bombed on that, he would be dead in the water. Like, he had planned on having, you know, several minutes of material as this thing, just one joke kept building on the next. And it comes off so effortlessly, of course. And yeah, a lot of it's confidence. He probably had tested that out on other audiences. And he just was absolutely certain it was going to work. And his body language let the audience know, oh, you're supposed to laugh at this. This is funny. But that just fascinates me about how you could have something like that where it's like its own little module in your act. And if it didn't work in the beginning, like, do you just kind of abort it? Or how does that, you know, do you get what I'm saying?
Well, there is. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of stuff that you do just have to get rid of. I mean, I had even in that joke, it's like there were other lines that I had to get rid of, because once I started connecting it to these other pieces, that line didn't really work anymore. And that sucks. That feeling kind of sucks when you have to throw away something that you wrote that you kind of like. That happens all the time. But what happens when you see the finish product in comedy, it kind of reminds me. So the like, I'm a big UFC fan. Mm-hmm. And what a lot of these UFC guys do is they'll be training. So if they're going to fight a 5-round fight what they do is they'll train for a 10-round fight, and they train 10 rounds where each round they throw a fresh guy in there. So you're fighting a new guy who's completely fresh for the sake. So you're going into the fifth, sixth, seventh round, and you're fighting someone who's fresh. And the idea of it is just like, once you get into the actual fight, this is substantially easier than what you trained for. So you're prepared. So with comedy, the connection I make there is that when you finally sit down and do a special, like when I recorded Libertas, it's now I've got a sold out theater of people who are fans of mine who came to see my comedy special. Like, they're already excited. They're on board with what I do. They're like, oh, this is what we're here for, this taping. Those jokes that I'm doing there were worked out, you know, at times in a room full of 20 people with 12 of them drunk and 3 of them pissed off that they were overcharged for drinks. And you know what I mean? And it's like, right. If you can get a laugh
and
out of those guys.
And they might not even have known who you were.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Probably. Almost certainly didn't know who I was. So if you can get a laugh out of those guys, once you get in, it's like, you know, it's like running with a lead vest on and then taking that off. And it's like, oh, this is the easy part. So you don't go in there like, oh, I'm worried about this joke not working. It's like, no. I've been through the wood chipper with it.
I got you. All right. Well, that's okay. Good. That's great. But let me, again, forgive me, but I got you here. I got to ask. More specifically, though, I don't just mean like you're trimming the fat over time. I mean, if somehow it ever turned out that you were deploying what you thought was going to be 3 minutes of a great anecdote that just kept building and you had all these little offshoot lines and you just sensed for some reason in the beginning the crowd was not into it, like, would you kind of wrap that up more quickly than you normally would have? You get what I'm saying? Like, is there a way you kind of abort mission and move on to the next thing if you just can sense for whatever reason this one's not working tonight?
Yeah, well, there's absolutely. There's been many situations where I've done that. There's a lot of nuance into the judgment that you make, and you'll certainly do things like your timing gets affected by what is going on in the room. So sometimes you'll just rush through something, or sometimes you'll just bail on it. I've done that many times, or I'll just bail completely on a bit, just be like, yeah, this isn't working. It's not working today with this crowd. Let me go into something that I know is going to work. Or something that I think has a better shot of working. And then there's been lots of times where a joke that I thought was really funny, just it's like, I don't know, I've tried this 10 times. It's not getting what I want out of it. I got to just put this away. Sometimes you'll come back to that like a couple years later or 6 months later. Mm-hmm. But there's been, you know, there's one of the things that I always thought was really interesting about stand-up comedy was it when you start doing it, you realize how many different layers of thoughts you can have simultaneously while you're doing stand-up. So I'll be telling a joke on stage, and in my mind I'm kind of debating over which joke I should do next. Like, I could do this joke or I could do this joke. And at the same time as I'm doing that, I'm noticing that this one guy over in the left side of the room hasn't laughed at all, and like this guy over here just spilled his drink. And while all of this is going on, I'm still saying the joke. Like, it's still all coming out, but I'm having all these thoughts at once. So I'll be doing a joke in a scenario like you laid out and just having a debate in my mind over, like, I might just cut this second part out. I might just end at this next laugh and then go out
of
here.
That's
and
it's
weird that you're able to do all of that stuff.
The only thing I can think of analogous to that with me is, you know, I play with a band doing live music in certain venues, especially on the Contra Cruise, which all of you folks should come to, contracruise.com. And the song Come Together, the Beatles Come Together, the lyrics for that are really hard to remember because they're such nonsense.
Yeah.
And so I'll be singing, and then once we, you know, come together, and as they're going through the, you know, the chorus, I'll be reminding myself of where are we in the song? Let's make sure I don't accidentally, like, go into the wrong stanza, because then that'd be hard to, you know, that'd be hard to fix on the fly. So, like, you know, and I'm sure some people watching are just like, oh, Bob's really into music and groove. And well, no, I'm actually sitting there thinking, I don't want to flub the note. What's the next line? And so that is interesting that your mind's racing and you're looking ahead while it probably looks to the crowd like you're totally in the moment and just delivering the punchline.
Uh-huh.
Okay, very good. Okay, I have just a few more comedy questions. And then I want to switch to the libertarian stuff that, you know, most of our listeners here know you for. But this is something that fascinates me too, is when people have a persona that they do. So just to give three obvious examples, like Gilbert Gottfried.
I visited Dr. Kevorkian the other day. And he said, how are you? And I went, fine. I feel great. I feel terrific. I don't know. know. To me, you look kind of pale. No, I feel fantastic.
Bobcat Goldthwait, if you remember, you know, him from the Police Academy movies. And Larry the Cable Guy.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Remain seated. Remain seated. Please do not rush the stage. Well, doggone it, get her done. Doggone. What are the odds I'd say that when I come out here? You would never expect that, would you?
And what just fascinates me is, like, they had to decide early on that that's the persona I'm going to do. And, of course, there's a selection bias. Like, I only know about them because they were successful. But, I mean, how do they – do you get what I mean? Like, when you're an unknown, do you just decide, you know, I'm going to speak with a really high voice and maybe it's going to work and I'm going to be famous for that? Or you get what I mean? Like, it's kind of hard to come back from that. And I think actually the Bobcat Goldthwait guy just, I think he stopped doing that voice and now he just does regular stand-up, I believe.
Yeah, I can't offer too much insight into that because that's just so far different from what my style is. But I call them like character comedians.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, and this isn't passing judgment on any of them, but it seems like a nightmare to me. Like, it seems like a nightmare.
Well, it's so risky to me. It seems like really high risk, high reward kind of thing.
Well, number one, it's risky, right? But then it's like what happens is, so like Larry the Cable Guy had like several characters. And then this one just blows up. And now he's kind of trapped in it. It's like, that's your life now.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay. So you're saying that guy at a given special, like a given act, like would do different voices?
He used to have different characters and Larry the Cable Guy was one of them. And this one just took off. Now, I'm not like, you know, saying like, you know, cry him a river. I mean, right. The guy's made, you know, obscene amounts of money doing that character.
I'm sure if he heard you say, he'd be like, Dave, I'm all right. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, you know, it's like,
which
right,
Cars
he's
movie
like,
were you in, Dave Smith? I can't remember.
Exactly, right, exactly. Like, you know, he's lying back on a pile of cash, like listening to this podcast. But it's like, to me, I just mean it artistically, where it would seem like if you ever, what if like a genuine thought came to you that you wanted to explore on stage? Well, you can't really do it because now you have to do it through this character. But there's a lot of guys like that, and it's a weird, I don't know what it must be, like a weird psychological thing where I see a lot of them kind of become the character. Like a lot of them, like it's like they start in their first, you know, beginning of comedy and they're like, oh, I think this is funny. And then they almost kind of like, you know, I think like Dice, I think, basically became Dice.
Yeah, yeah.
But this was a character that he was doing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's clearly a character. This isn't how a real person is. But now he's almost like just, I think he may have even lost where the character begins and the person ends. For me personally, those have never been the comedians that I really gravitated toward. I'm not exactly sure why, but it's an interesting dynamic where people really do like play a role. I mean, I guess everyone does to some degree because you're not exactly the person who you are on stage. It's like an element of your personality. But man, doing that type of stuff, it's almost like they're half actor, improv, you know, comedic actor and half stand-up.
Okay. So yeah, so you don't know personally. Partly answers my question. I didn't realize the guy who does Larry the Cable Guy that he had several characters and that one just blew up. I guess it's kind of, I mean, we know more about Andy Kaufman, but like people who just knew him as Laka on Taxi, you know, he would probably think, yeah, that was just one of a million billion things I've done. And that's the thing that the pop culture embraced or, you know, that's what a lot of people know me as. Okay.
Yeah. And now Andy Kaufman is an example of that guy everything that I believe about comedy philosophy, I think he probably believed the opposite. And
really? I wasn't expecting you to say that. Tell us more.
I was never a big Kaufman fan. And I guess to me, the idea, like what I said before about like your job as a comedian is to kill the room, is to make everybody laugh. It seemed like his thing was like, that's irrelevant.
Okay, you're right.
Like making people laugh or not, that has nothing to do with it. I could come in and do a thing that nobody in the room gets, but it was hilarious to me.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like my – and I don't know. There was something about that that always rubbed me the wrong way.
Okay, because to me that was – so you're right. I with a lot of this stuff, I try not to let other people tell me who's cool. Like I noticed that I always appreciated Norm Macdonald, but I never thought he was like in the pantheon of great comedic geniuses until I heard guys like Bill Burr and whatever just talking in reverential tones about him. And then I'm all of a sudden like, oh yeah, Norm Macdonald. And same thing with Andy Kaufman, like until the Jim Carrey movie came out and everyone's saying how great he was, it was like, oh yeah. But say what you will, I think the thing with Andy Kaufman and Norm Macdonald is they just don't care, or at least they really come off like they don't care whether you think this is funny or not.
Yeah,
they don't need your approval.
I do think Norm Macdonald is a comedic genius. Mm-hmm. I think it, with him, it's just that his style is so unique and so different that a lot of people don't know what to make of him. But with the Andy Kaufman thing, it was like he would almost intentionally piss the audience off at times. I will say with Kaufman, what I loved that he did, I thought he was a hilarious professional wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that stuff was some of the funniest stuff I've ever seen, when he would just like taunt the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And then like his gimmick was that he only fought women.
Right.
And then he would like talk all this trash, and like Jerry Lawler would come out and challenge him, and he'd go, I only fight women.
Yeah.
I only fight women. And it's just, it was so funny to me.
Have you ever heard Lawler talk about, you know, like how that all, you know, about, you know, his history with Andy Kaufman?
Yeah, I have. It's pretty wild.
Because he said something, because I never got that at first. And then he said that, I'm not telling you, damn, for the listeners, that it was Kaufman got fascinated by seeing the villains in wrestling and how you know, if you think about it, like why should there be villains? But that makes it better for the crowd. Like the crowd wants to get, you know, they want to hate someone. And that's what the bad guys in wrestling would do. And Kaufman apparently was just fascinated by that, like to pull stuff. So that's what you're saying. Like, yeah, I think there were times where he did want to anger the crowd, like to be doing a joke and the joke was on them. And I think for whatever reason, he just thought there was something interesting about that he wanted to explore.
Well, I do. I agree. There is something interesting about it. It's very different from what is my cup of tea,
yeah,
as a comedian. But that's not that, you know, that's, it's completely subjective.
Yeah. You're like, is it the Snoop Dogg thing? We've got to give the people what they want. So
that's right.
Yeah, that's you deliver. You're a man of the people.
I've always said my biggest influences were Murray Rothbard and Snoop Doggy Dogg.
We have that in common. So I was more of an Eazy-E guy myself. I knew who Snoop was, but I was kind of moving away from that genre at that point in my life. Mm. Okay, I promised a last question on comedy, and then we'll move on. You said something on your – I think you were telling a story to Robbie the Fire, and you mentioned – you said this guy, he lit into the host, and that was like a real faux pas among comedians. I didn't even know what you meant by that. So why don't you just tell us something about this is the professional ethics courtesy among comedians.
Oh, okay. So here's a little behind the curtain stuff. Oh, yeah. So comedians, generally speaking, there'll be a light in the club that the club gives you. It's a little red light, and this will let you know your time's up or your time is
like,
coming
like
to an
built,
end.
It's a fix, like it's built into the architecture?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Built into the comedy club, there'll be a little red light. And, you know, like when you're going out to a set, you know, if you're doing whatever, if you're doing an hour, they'll be like, okay, what you want? I'll light you at 55 minutes. So, you know, cause you know, people kind of lose track of time and
right.
stuff. So
instead
like, okay,
of
so
someone
you know,
holding up a card that has a five on it or something.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Now some shows, some, you know, shows are done in, you know, venues that don't have a light. So sometimes the host of the show who's bringing the comedians up and all will just come and kind of wave a cell phone at you, or they'll put the flashlight on their cell phone. And so you just see a little light and you know, to wrap up. But what happened in this event was a comedian who was going on next in the show wanted to go on soon. So he came out and lit the comedian who was on stage to let him know to get off stage.
Okay. So the verb is you like the comedian?
Yes,
or do you only use it in the past tense? You only,
yeah, he, okay. Yeah, no, that would be it. You like the comedian or you lit the comedian. Either one is fine.
Okay.
But so this was, yes, within the comedy world, this was a grave insult because you're not supposed to do that.
Okay. Is that because it's like effectively you're telling him that, hey, you know, it's my turn and get off. It just kind of
yeah, wrote. Basically. And it's not, it wasn't really, you know, that that comedian's place to do that. And anyway, a whole feud ensued between those two comedians.
All right, very.
As I retell it, I realize how profoundly childish it is.
Well, no, but I do need to, you know, we need to know. I don't want to. So it's good, you know, if I'm ever, you know, doing a set with Bill Burr or something, I don't want to just flash my cell phone at him and he misinterprets what happened. So it's good to know.
Given the scenario where you are working with Bill Burr, I'd say you just let him do his time.
What are you trying to say there, Dave? All right.
Oh, just nothing against you. Just a compliment to Bill Burr.
Well, you know, you keep being offensive and maybe Gene Epstein gets him to intro the Soho Forum. You know, who knows?
It's quite possible. That is a very real possibility.
Folks, let's take a break from my conversation with Dave Smith to talk about fiscal policy. No, I'm not talking about the federal government. I'm talking about the Bob Murphy Show. So things are fine. It's not as if the lights are about to be shut off. But if you guys want me to be able to provide more content, I am going to have to ask you for a little something for the effort. So the problem is, of course, Patreon is no longer in the good graces of the libertarian community. So I don't want to get hitched up with them. So for right now, what I'm going to do is ask for those of you who want to contribute, I'm just asking you for a one-shot donation here just until we get a better funding option available. And so I'm just going to use PayPal, or if you want to send me crypto, that's fine too. I have the information available if you go to bobmurphyshow.com/contribute. And for right now, to sweeten the pot, what I'll say is if you send me at least $25, then I'll give you access to the all-new top secret Facebook group about the Bob Murphy Show. And if you send me $50, then not only do you get access to the top secret Facebook group, but also I will autograph and send you one of my books. So again, for all the information on how you would go about doing that, go to bobmurphyshow.com/contribute. Thanks for your support. Okay, so why don't we transition now into how did you start? Well, okay, you got into politics. I think I've heard you say, and correct me if I'm getting this wrong, you heard this guy Ron Paul talking about the Fed and you actually thought he, come on, that can't be right. Is that accurate?
Well, it wasn't. Well, no, I heard first, it was the Ron Paul Giuliani moment that just won me over. I was like, oh, who is that guy? And it just made me really interested. And I just started looking up all his stuff. And then he had won me over so much on the anti-war stuff. I was already anti-war, but I was like, this guy's making the best anti-war argument. Like he made everybody else seem like, you know, they, even when people would criticize Bush, it was like they're not really going at the heart of the issue here.
So, okay, that's interesting. So it wasn't merely that you were saying, hey, for a Republican, this guy's not half bad. You actually thought this is the best message of anti-war protest I've heard.
Yeah, and it wasn't just that, you know, George Bush had gotten us into the wrong war or that he lied us into this. I mean, I was already convinced about all that stuff.
Right, but we don't have an exit strategy as if that's the,
yes,
you know, the issue.
Right. But it wasn't just that. It was that Ron Paul actually said, why do you think 9/11 happened to begin with? You know, it was the whole going through the history and the idea that we shouldn't be doing this at all. This is evil. And that it was like, had a huge impact on me. And then it was like he kept talking about all this free market stuff. And I didn't really have a perspective one way or the other. I mean, I probably would have been just like a typical kind of, you know, more or less left-wing type of attitude. Like I was like, well, no, I mean, I remember I used to think really stupid things, just economically illiterate thoughts that I used to have that seemed to make sense to me. Like in my 20s, I remember thinking like, you know, really no one should have more than $10 million. I mean, who needs more than that? You know what I mean? Like, and if you had told me, oh, we should tax rich people higher to help out poor people, I'd be like, yeah, of course. I mean, that's just like common sense. Who wouldn't support that?
Real quick on that, I remember when I was young, I mean, I'm talking like eighth grade or something, and I learned about the progressive income tax and what that meant. And I was astonished that there had ever been a point at which taxes weren't levied more higher rate. Depending on, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I didn't realize that was a thing. Like, why would we even need to put an adjective on the front of it? Of course, all taxes should be more a higher rate if you're richer.
Yeah, that was, it just seemed intuitive to me. And it was like, and it was almost like it was very easy to fall into the left wing thing where it's like, I guess you would just have to be an evil, heartless person to not agree with that, because what would the other argument be? And a higher minimum wage, all those things. I would have been like, yeah, of course. I mean, there's people who have so little. Why wouldn't you raise their wages? But I had never really thought it through. You know, I didn't. So Ron Paul kept making this free market argument, and he had won so much credibility with me on the war stuff that I was like, well, let me hear him out. Like, what is the argument here? Because this guy clearly isn't that heartless guy who doesn't care about poor people. This is the guy who's appalled that these people who are far poorer than our poor people are getting slaughtered. So that was enough to kind of make me curious. And then he kept talking about the Federal Reserve, and I knew nothing about the Federal Reserve. Like, I had heard the name before, but I didn't really understand what they were, what they did. And I remember the thing you were bringing up where I really thought to myself, I was like, this can't be right. Like, he was describing how the Fed works, and I was like, no. This can't be right, because everybody would be outraged about this, and certainly I would have heard of it.
Right. Can I stop? Do you mean at this point when you're saying how, like, him from giving a stump speech on the Fed, or you got his book at this point and thought this can't be right, the stuff he says on page 20 of his book?
I think this might have been even before I had ever read any of his books. Okay. I think this was just me, like, YouTubing videos of him, maybe reading some articles that he had written, but listening to him talk. It was listening to him talk about the Federal Reserve before I even got the books, before I even found Mises.org. I think I found Mises.org in my search after I was like, I was basically like, okay, so you're telling me there's this secret cabal of bankers in this privately owned bank, and we don't get to know anything that they do, and they have all these shady deals, and they're making money off of it, and then I just decided to look it up more, and I was blown away that in fact this was actually exactly how it worked, and that nobody thought this was something that needed to be discussed all the time, let alone there wasn't some huge outrage about it. And then through, you know, like, Googling Ron Paul and stuff like that, I found Peter Schiff and Tom Woods, and then I found the Mises Institute, and then I just really dove into it. I started, you know, I think I went and bought like every Ron Paul book there was, and I was like I was in this weird position at that time in my life where it kind of lined up perfectly, where I was a new comedian. I had some comedians who were bringing me out on the road to open for them as their feature to their headlining, and so I was making just enough money that I didn't have to have a day job, but could be really broke.
Mm-hmm.
You like just pay my bills, sometimes fall behind on my bills. But I had a lot of free time, and I found like the Mises.org, and I just found this stuff so interesting. I remember I used to go over to my mother's house, and I used to print out like books from Mises.org, because there's just, you know, like a book's worth of stuff. And because my eyes were hurting from reading off the computer, because I had like some old crappy like laptop with one of those weird screens, and I would print these things out and just like read all night long and just get like obsessed over this stuff. And but yeah, and then it was like once I really started reading Rothbard, that's when it was it was all over for me.
I'm kind of waiting for the part of the story where you found my stuff and it just completed your education.
And then I found your stuff. And then I was like, I'm not a libertarian at all. I mean, this is just, if this guy's on the team, I don't want to be a part of this at all.
Weird.
No, but it was all of, once I found, you know, the Mises Institute, I found all you guys and started reading all your stuff.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this, because you said something. Tom doesn't like when people bring this up, but I was going in, the issue is to not ramble too much, that the Fed is actually, there's a sense in which it's privately owned. And I went, when I was in Nashville, somebody contacted me and said, yeah, we're going to go protest. So it wasn't like an official Federal Reserve branch office, but it was, you know, whatever the Fed's presence was in Nashville. And we were out there and we had megaphones and stuff. And I gave a quick little thing. And I just noticed, though, that like one of the guys with the billboard that he had made, and he was, you know, cars were passing by and he was waving at him, was saying the Fed is privately owned. And, you know, so I get why Tom thinks that's, you know, like, oh, geez, of all the things you can complain about. But on the other hand, I think if you were trying to explain to someone about big pharma and you said, oh, yeah, do you know that pharmaceutical companies all own stock in the FDA? That would freak people out.
Yeah.
And so likewise, I think when, you know, you tell people and they haven't heard this before, they say, do you know that actually the Federal Reserve, its stock is owned by private banks? They're kind of, they think you're making, like, yeah, go to the Federal Reserve's website, go look it up. And it's, for whatever reason, that kind of just jolts people, even though, you know, as Tom points out, that per se is not a huge deal. But I think that does alert people to the fact that this is screwy. Like, this is even screwier than the FDA or the EPA or whatever. This is weird. Like, you know, imagine if oil companies all owned the EPA. Wouldn't that be kind of weird?
Yeah, no, I absolutely. Well, I think what it does, I mean, I understand Tom's point. And certainly, you know, like there's something where some left-wing people who challenge the Fed, you know, the three of them, they will kind of say like, well, it should be run by Congress and it shouldn't be privately owned. And that's the problem with it. But I do think initially to someone being introduced to it, it does jolt you into understanding things better to be like, no, this isn't just something that's like being done, you know, like the way they kind of try to present what government is as this, well, this is just here to make sure everything's fair and to make sure the economy is running smoothly. It's like, oh no, people are getting rich off of this scheme. There is something to me about that that's still, to me, what outrages me about so much of the kind of fascistic, you know, public-private relationship.
Oh, the fact that it is, it's, how can I put it? Are you saying, so what you're saying is that it's, it would be one thing if they really were just honest mistakes, you know, horrible mistakes, but that people in charge were trying to, you know, bring freedom to the Middle East. But then if you found out, oh no, the real reason behind it was, you know, these groups were, you know, it was all about missile and arms deals and da 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 da. You're saying like that gives an extra layer of horror?
Yeah, exactly. Well, like if it was something where like, oh, okay, like we really did think that there were weapons of destruction in Iraq and we really felt like it would make it a much better society if we took this action or something, perhaps it wouldn't be so outrageous if it wasn't like, oh, people are making billions off of this. And then those same people are supporting the misinformation that leads us into these wars where they can make billions. Like that's that stuff. It drives home to me more of like what's really going on here. So you can kind of see like, oh, no, it's not what they tell us it is. It's not that at all.
Mm-hmm. And what is funny, too, is, you know, a lot of people have no problem saying, oh, yeah, the tobacco companies, they systematically lie to the American people to maintain their profits. And yet if you say, OK, so maybe, you know, the major media are bought by the corporate interests because, you know, of the war machine. And they think that that's a nutty idea when, you know, the war machine is way more profitable than selling cigarettes.
Oh, absolutely. And there's, but that's, you know, that is the thing that is just so infuriating to me about the left. And I know they would say to us that, oh, you've got, you know, like I get this, you know, on Twitter and stuff a lot where people say like, oh, you know, you hate the state, but you just worship big business or something like that. But at least if you want to make a comparison, I can argue like, well, who does more damage really? I mean, who's killed more people, jailed more people, ruined more lives? Let's compare like the 20th century states to businesses. And it's not even close, but it will be. It does seem for a lot of people on the left, it's so easy to get them upset at business. And there's obviously lots of things business has done often in conjunction with the state, but it's like, yeah, I mean, look at, you know, like Scott Horton said to me, which I thought was a great example, where he was like, so why is Boeing advertising on MSNBC? Why is Meet the Press brought to you by Boeing? I mean, doesn't that seem a little bit strange? Like, what are they trying to sell me something as I watch Meet the Press? Or is it maybe just that they like to cut a big check over to NBC News? You know, like there's—
I never even thought of that. Huh.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I just assumed it was, you know, you're in the market for a 747. And,
right,
you know,
yeah.
You could go to Consumer Reports. You could watch the news.
But there's a lot of, you know, and then, of course, once you start to, I mean, I think that, to me, the essence of this whole libertarian business, what it all comes down to, it is like almost deprogramming people from a religion, the religion of statism, where you just, it really comes down to the fact that the government is a group of people just like everybody else, that they're people too. And that's why it's not, you know, if anybody else was doing what this group of people are doing, we'd all be together on this. Luckily for us, in most, you know, in first world Western countries, pretty much everybody, with the exception of criminals and maybe like Antifa and things like that, pretty much everybody accepts the non-aggression principle in every inch of life except the state. And it's the question is, why do you carve out this exception for them?
Well, it's interesting you say that, Dave, because that was something, and it's in the grand scheme, it's minor, but it was really disturbing me, the whole punch a Nazi thing. Remember how that was a big deal? Was it Richard Spencer got, and everyone was just laughing. And what concerned me, I mean, obviously I get how someone could say, yeah, I'm not losing sleep over the fact, but that's not merely what people were saying. I mean, they were outright, I mean, for one thing, the phrase was trending, punch a Nazi, but also I didn't get the sense that a lot of people were saying, yeah, that guy shouldn't have done that, but I can understand why he did it. I wasn't getting that message at all. I was getting, ha ha, look at this a-hole get punched. Ha ha, he deserved it.
And then it puts you in this situation where it's like, believe me, I'm not trying to defend Richard Spencer. That's not really my goal. But if you're going to say that, oh, it's okay to punch a Nazi, you can already see, and of course there, you saw this when Rand Paul got attacked, that this becomes this slippery slope thing where basically a Nazi is defined as anyone to the right of Bernie Sanders. And the truth is that Richard Spencer is not a Nazi.
Yeah.
It's not really accurate to call him a Nazi. I mean, you can call him racist. I'm okay with that. He's certainly like wants a white ethno state, and he's got, you know, absolutely no understanding of economics, which actually offends me more than any of the other stuff, which may just say something about me. But,
and by the way, for listeners who are uncomfortable, Dave's allowed to talk like that because of his ethnic background. I just want to clarify.
There we go.
Yeah.
There we go.
I couldn't say that. I would be, but you can say it.
Well, but you know, it's also like I hate the idea that we're supposed to – first of all, it's like, look, the Nazis – When you bring up the Nazis, and this is something that, you know, I have some my family has some experience with, the reason why Nazis are horrible is because there was a genocide committed, that wars were started, that people died in just brutal, horrific conditions. And, you know, if there is someone, you know, even somebody who's got like a swastika tattoo on them, who's marching in Charlottesville or who's advocating these things, I don't quite give them all that credit. Like, you're now a part of this genocidal regime. My honest feeling is like, man, I feel pity for that person. Like, something's going on in this person's life. They probably had a lot of issues in their childhood. They're probably like, I don't know that we should lose humanity for anyone who isn't actually doing anything violent, but just has some views that we find repugnant. And then to say, if you're going to be okay with them saying like, well, also somebody who's a white nationalist is a Nazi, and also somebody who's just racist is a Nazi. This is going, you know, it's a very slippery slope to just saying like, oh, okay, basically it's okay for us to, you know, use violence against someone we have a political disagreement, which actually is kind of in common with what the Nazis thought. So, you know, my thing that was always, you know, from the libertarian perspective, and this is what we were talking about before, when it's like realizing what the state actually is. And this is why I still say to this day that, to me, Anatomy of the State is the most important thing I ever read. And it's the thing that I recommend people read first. I think once you look at the state for what it is, it changes your perception on all these other things. But to say, okay, let's say that Richard Spencer advocates for, like, you know, a certain racial class, and we're going to say that makes him a Nazi. Well, I'm much more concerned about, you know, Obama signing into law the right to detain American citizens indefinitely. How about that comparison to the Nazis? Like that just concerns me much more than a few hundred losers marching in Charlottesville.
And it is interesting, too, along those lines of, you know, how people will say, oh, you can't, like white people are racist, but oppressed groups, they can't be in the same way because they don't have any power. So it is interesting how on the left, power dynamics really infuses a lot of what they do. And so then, yeah, you'd say, okay, so why are you freaking out about a bunch of, you know, young 20s, guys in their 20s who, I'm not making, just observing, that my guess is, like you said, they probably were not like the most successful guys in high school, and we're going to mock them. And they say, yeah, people who are in charge of the war machine bombing other countries with all that power, and they're not really high up on our list of priorities. That seems weird for people who are looking at the world in terms of power dynamics.
Yeah, well, that's a really great point. And I never even thought of it exactly that way, but that's a really great point. But, you know, it's like, I remember you said one time that always really stuck with me. You were talking about this in a speech. I think you've mentioned this point a few different times, but where you said that, you know, people will be like, they'll talk about the government, or they'll talk about politicians, and they'll be like, these guys are such dopes that they tax tobacco and subsidize tobacco. or you know what I mean? They run these anti-tobacco ads, and then they also subsidize the tobacco companies or whatever. And it's like, no, they're not dopes. Like, we're the dopes.
Right.
They know exactly what they're doing. And a lot of the stuff that I've just realized with those, you know, so many of those left-wing people, it's not like you're like, oh, but here's a contradiction in what you're doing. Isn't this kind of doping? It's like, no, they know exactly what they're doing. And it's not that they really, you know, believe that power and privilege equals this. This is just a rationalization for why they can be anti-white. And it is like it's all over the place, man. Like a true hatred for Christianity, a hatred for straight white men, and a hatred for Western civilization. It's that lens is the only lens you could look through where everything actually makes sense. Now it actually all makes sense. Because if you really cared about gay rights, then you wouldn't be, you know, you'd be criticizing Muslim countries or South American countries. It wouldn't just be white men. And of course, you know, to say Christianity is not an oppressed group. I mean, maybe you can argue that in America, but worldwide, that certainly isn't true.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. That's really interesting. So yeah, for people who haven't heard me make that, the issue is, and I had heard this growing up, that people would mock the government and say the right hand doesn't know what the left's doing. Like, ha, the same government that funds anti-smoking campaigns for, you know, children in the schools is also the one that subsidizes tobacco farmers. And like Dave's saying, you know, that's supposed to be a contradiction. But no, when you analyze it in terms of the individuals and their motivation, the thing that does have to fall away is that you believe the politicians when they explain what their motivations are. Like, yeah, that's a cover story. But when you actually look at what's, you know, their incentive structure, that makes perfect sense that they're doing both of those simultaneously. So yeah, that had never occurred to me that it's we're sort of being suckers by trying to analyze the official, let's say, like leftist policy prescriptions and saying, but wait a minute, according to you, this should follow, but you're not doing that. Huh, let me ponder that.
Right. Well, it's like there's so many logical inconsistencies in their worldview mm-hmm. that it's almost like, okay, well, I don't actually buy that this is what you believe. And I don't buy that, you know, even though some of them may not even know it, I don't really buy that, you know, you're just a more empathetic person, or you just care about transgender people. Like you really just care about the struggle of some kid who's struggling with his gender identity and the fact that he had a tough life. You just really care about that more than me. It's like, no, I think what's going on here after seeing this happen time and time again, it's like you are getting really into hating anybody who isn't as noble as you. That's what's going on here. And and you've decided there's this one class that is like the straight white men or whatever, that you're just allowed to get all of your evil out on. You can get it all out on this one group of people. And when you start to realize that, you're like, oh, you actually have a lot more in common with the racists that you hate than any of us do.
Yeah, that's something that has come out for me more in this, you know, this post-Trump era, like seeing the media figures and how unbelievably dishonest they are. And of course, you know, and people are like, oh, well, Trump lies too. Right, but he's a president and people know that politicians lie. I mean, that's kind of common knowledge, whereas the media holding themselves up as the purveyors of truth. It's amazing to me just the nonchalance. And we're going through with this BuzzFeed thing as we speak and how the special prosecutor office said that wasn't accurate, whatever. And just how they're shrugging it off. And I mean, I really, somebody said that the virtue of the Trump's presidency was that these people like show their true colors or something, like, you know what I mean? Like, in other words, it kind of pulled these people out so you could see exactly where they stand and they couldn't hide behind, you know, this video. Another example of the kind of thing I think you're talking about, Dave, is I've noticed that my work on energy issues where people talk about climate change and like they're using apocalyptic language. And no, you don't understand. If we don't act within 10 years, your grandchildren might be underwater. I mean, that kind of level of the humanity is at stake, an existential threat. And yet they're not all running around clamoring for nuclear power.
Yeah.
When that's emission free and, you know, that wouldn't be nearly as hard to transition to as just having everything be wind and solar. And it's like, I don't actually believe you. I think it's more you don't like capitalism. You don't like American standard of living. And so another example, too, is that renewable portfolio standards, like to have renewable energy being involved in electricity production in states where hydropower is a big factor of that. they don't count that.
Yeah.
It's like if it actually made economic sense, well, that doesn't count. That's too easy. It's got to be painful, and we got to, you know. So the things like that where even on their own terms, the stuff that pops out doesn't fit up with the, you know, the rhetoric.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. And on the, you know, it's like if you downplay what you think the effects of climate change are going to be by an inch, you're like a denier and you're this horrible person. But you can literally say, I mean, Bernie Sanders said it's going to make the world uninhabitable for our children. And there's like no pushback on that at all. Like, that's a pretty outrageous claim to make. I mean, we really shouldn't be talking about anything else then. Like, who cares about the minimum wage? Why are you spending so much time on that?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So by the way, the way you and Robbie went through that last Tucker Carlson monologue, well, it wasn't a monologue, he had a guest on. That was really great stuff. And it was, in particular, I liked how you caught him on the thing with the experts. Do you remember that? Where, where the, you know, all these experts are saying there's going to be 50% unemployment. And then he brings on, who was it, Austin Goolsbee, and dismisses that guy by saying, well, you know, you and these other people didn't see the 2008 crisis coming, and you just observed. I'm sure of all the guys warning about 50% unemployment from AI, I wonder how many of them predicted the 2008 crisis, but yet his standard for what makes somebody, you know, a reputable expert seemed to change within 2 minutes on the show.
Yeah, man, it's you know, with Tucker Carlson stuff, it hurts me in a way, because I really do think that Tucker Carlson is, of all the huge popular cable news conservative hosts, I think he is the best ever. I mean, I really do. Like, he's been incredible on standing up to the military industrial complex, incredible at standing up to the craziness of left-wing culture. I really, really admire him on so many issues, but he's been on this anti-capitalist kick, and it's almost like he forces my hand. Like, I can't not respond to this. I mean, the thing that really got me was that I just couldn't believe the words actually came out of his mouth, was that he said that technological advances have made working people's labor less valuable than it's ever been.
Right.
And I couldn't believe he would make a statement like that. I mean, and you know, he falls into this thing where it's almost like, because the, I guess, Republicans use a lot of free market rhetoric, then he basically decides that the cause of all our problems is that these guys just love the free market so much. And I just can't believe Tucker Carlson, who's been around these circles, like he was aware of Ron Paul and these guys. I can't believe he'd be so wrong, so spectacularly wrong about this stuff. But to the point you were making, it's like, I like the idea that he's like, hey, nobody saw this this crash coming. You know, none of these economists have a really good explanation for why the economy booms and then busts. I mean, it would be really nice if some of them had a theory worked out on that. And you're like, wait, really? Really? Oh, well, there is kind of this one little group, you know.
Yeah. The thing that, and just for so people at home, because I know, and I get pushback from some people who are really just on the war issue, and they kind of roll their eyes like, oh, yeah, you're going to take shots at Tucker Carlson. Come on, he's the best guy out there. You know what I mean? It's sort of like they want you to pull your punches. But number one is, precisely because he's this rising star among, let's say, people who listen to you and me, that I do think when he's going off the rails, you know, we should say something. But also number two is I don't care. Like, if he just said, you know what, free trade dogma, you know, I've looked at the case for this, and, you know, they use models about two countries and there's sweater and wine. And is that even applicable in today's economy? If he said stuff like that, I would have no problem. It's the certainty with which he just blows these people up when he says things, like you said, that are patently absurd. Like, yeah, right now, American workers, you know, are the least value, getting less value for their time of all. What was the quote you just said there? You weren't putting words in his mouth. He really did say that. And in context, yeah. That's what he was trying to convey. And it was like, what are you talking about? That, yeah, so people in 1800 had a higher standard of living than we do. So,
right,
yeah.
Or just people today who live in countries without technology or technological advances. I mean, it's like, and you know, the reason why I do think it's really important to criticize Tucker Carlson with that stuff, and the reason why I really, the core of why I ever engaged with people in the alt-right, and why I try to engage with, you know, Trump supporters and the kind of the broader kind of right-wing populist movement, is that, you know, I watched the Ron Paul movement to a large degree be absorbed by these guys. And I know that, you know, I've had people message me stuff where they'll be like, you know, whether they're talking about like the Proud Boys or Trump supporters. And they'll be like, look, man, there are a lot of libertarians in that group. And there are a lot of people who would have loved to see Ron Paul as president who are supporting Trump now because they just, you know, they feel like this is the only shot. This is the only thing. And I really had high hopes and had my heart broken. You know, I remember during the Ron Paul, during 2012 and stuff like that, where people were like, you know what? It doesn't even matter because we've taken over all these delegate positions. We've got all the young Republicans on our side. And in the next few years, this is just, it's going to be impossible to stop. And to see it be kind of taken over and go in this other direction, it's like, well, I still want to be able to talk to some of those guys and win over some of their listeners and be like, no, listen, whether or not you think using Trump or using this nationalist stuff is a good, you know, tactical idea, just know that this stuff is wrong. You know, this is not the direction you want to go. And it's only going to lead to more of what of the problems that we've had.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. If it's the, you know, you got to say the truth. And yeah, like you're saying, to the extent that, yeah, a lot of people might be following that just as part of the crowd. Well, you know, this is the one group that's going to stand up to Hillary and the Democrats. And we got to, you know, strengthen numbers. But yeah, at least to say, okay, just so you guys know, though, like the economics behind this are nutty. Okay. Let's make sure we all understand that.
Yeah.
Well, the last thing I wanted to ask you, you know, whatever you're comfortable sharing, but you had brought up on your show after, you know, congratulations on, you know, getting married and having a baby. And you brought up some stuff about, you know, how that fundamentally changed your life. And so I'm just wondering if you want to, can you elaborate on that a little bit as a final thing we'll share with the listeners here?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's thank you very much. And it's actually today my baby is 6 weeks old. So it's been incredible. Very challenging, but really the most amazing 6 weeks of my life. And this last year has just been the best year of my life and getting married. And, you know, I'm really so lucky. I found like such an incredible woman and she's just like, you know, just amazing. You know, with the stuff you're talking about, I think, you know, was like kind of finding God and really, you know, it's one of these things that it's very hard to put into words or to explain, but it's just, I think I've seen like how much I'm capable of loving others and putting others, you know, above myself. And there's this weird dynamic of being a human where you almost, you know, when you're, you know, it's almost like something that's kind of Randian, which is weird to quote when you're talking about God. Mm-hmm. But there's something about where that selfishness, if you're doing it in a way where you're not thinking through the long-term implications, is actually hurting yourself. It's not selfishness, it's self-destructive. And as I've started kind of living for other people, I've found that I have more personal happiness than I've ever found before. And there was something, it really was the process the day that Lauren delivered where I felt like, you know, first of all, it was very scary. It was a very, very scary situation where, you know, I mean, like the doctors and nurses aren't scared. They do this stuff all the time. But when it's your wife and baby who are going through it, it's really scary. And I faced, you know, just some dark thoughts about like, oh my God, I could lose my wife. Oh my God, I could lose the baby. Mm-hmm. And immediately when I was faced with that, I started talking to God. Mm-hmm. And I, as somebody who never was a big believer, I never really grew up a religious person or grew up with, you know, with a relationship with God or anything like that. It was a very eye-opening experience to see how naturally and instinctively I went right to talk to God.
Were you like cutting a deal with him? Like if you let them get through this, I'll clean my act up or something?
Oh
or?
My God, deals left and right. Deals left and right.
Because I've done that too at points in my life. So I'm just saying that's natural.
Yeah. But that's exactly what I did. And it's like, oh, you go right away. And then, but there's something very eye-opening about that because then you're like, oh man, so my instinct is to go right to a conversation with God. And then there's also these things that I know that God would be happier with me if I was doing in my life instead of this. And it's hard, you know, I mean, I guess once you kind of come out of that and everyone's okay, it's easy to go like, ah, well, that was just something where I was in that moment. But I just, you know, like every day through my daughter, I feel like I see it. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I almost, I feel like I can't believe I wasn't, you know, it's not that the way I look at it isn't like, oh, I used to be an atheist and now I believe in God. I look at it like I always knew this was real, mm-hmm. and I was kind of denying it for a long time. But to me, it's just that you could argue that there's something just that we've evolved or in some way to have this instinct to feel like there's a God. But I don't know. There's something about that like that's a pretty weird thing, man, that it's just in all of us. And I don't care who you are, the most hardcore atheist, when you're on a plane that's crashing, I know for a fact that's what your mind goes to. You would have to be fighting it to not start looking toward a God. And I've just been more, I am convinced that there is like much deeper meaning to this existence, that there is a higher purpose to all of this. And I mean, again, it's almost frustrating because I can't exactly put into words what I kind of know with certainty, mm-hmm. in my heart. But yeah, it's been a profound life-changing experience for me. I've also changed some, I guess you could call them political views. I was talking about this on my last podcast, but I've completely changed from the pro-choice to pro-life position. I mean, I just think that there's no way to justify abortion on moral grounds. And
Even baby Hitler.
Even baby Hitler. How about you try loving baby Hitler and raising him the right way? Then there's no Hitler.
For people who don't wear it, Ben Shapiro got in trouble. He was at a pro-life rally and he made an analogy to say that, yes, we wouldn't even kill baby Hitler. And ironically, the kind, compassionate left was biting his head off for not being willing to kill a baby. It was interesting, but in any event. That's great, Dave. And again, congratulations. And I was just so happy to hear that when you were talking about that in the podcast. You mentioned something about the selfishness. This last anecdote I'll share here is somebody, it was going around on Facebook, like this article about surveys show that, you know, having a child makes couples, you know, unhappy or what. Like, in other words, they were like polling people and the couples that didn't have a kid were happier than the other one. And, you know, there was some subjective measurement. Oh, we get to go out more and whatever. But I shared that on my Facebook and I said something like, okay, in a, you know, whatever you want to say that. But on the other hand, you know, when you have a kid, you realize if it would spare your infant from getting pneumonia, you would chop off one of your fingers. You would just be sitting saying, which finger do I want to chop off? It wouldn't be, you know, that's how you know, your self-interest gets, you know, transferred into, you know, this other person that it's not even an issue in terms of, oh, am I living for myself at this point?
Right, right. And it's so like, there's a couple elements there. Number one, it's completely faulty science to measure happiness by asking people questions. And so, you know, it's like, it's also not like happiness, however you define that. I mean, it's not necessarily what life's all about. I mean, like purpose and meaning, yeah, and being
good. And also,
good.
I think the word joy, like, okay, they might be happier if that means, but which has more joy? That, to me, that's not even close.
Yes. Well, that's right. And it's like, I don't know, you know, you could find some measure to watch some guy, you know, sitting on the couch eating potato chips, and then find someone who's training for a marathon and be like, who's experiencing more happiness, you know, in this moment, depending on how you measure it.
Right,
and you might
be
like, well, this guy's sitting on the couch. But if you deduced from that it's a way better thing to do to sit on a couch and eat potato chips than run a marathon, which, by the way, I would prefer to sit on a couch and eat potato chips. But but it's like, no, I mean, there's a little bit more to it.
In each round, you would get a fresh bag of potato chips just to really make sure you're on your game. Yeah,
yeah, but you know, it's like, so, okay, but if you're actually talking about what, because that is, you know, I mean, it's hard. I mean, yes, there are moments like, you know, last night she was pretty good, but the night before that, I was up till 5 in the morning with a crying baby. And it's like, yeah, I'm sure at some moment in that I wasn't experiencing pure happiness. But like, if you're talking about meaning and purpose, those things far outweigh a little temporary pleasure. So I question how they're even measuring those things. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, like I don't even, when you talk about like the sacrifice you would make for your child, it's not even, I don't even view it as a sacrifice. I don't like my daughter is me. Mm-hmm. She is my wife. She's us. So it's not, it's almost like, to use another UFC analogy, but it's almost like if someone, you know, was like throwing a punch at your face and you put your hands up and you take the punch on your arms, like you block it. And someone would be like, oh, I can't believe you sacrificed your arms for your jaw. And it's like, it's not even a sacrifice. This is my face is just a more important part of me. Right. I can't let them hit me here. So I'd rather take it on the arm. Like that's me. I'm the arm and she's the chin, you know, like that's, right. It's that simple. So I just couldn't imagine anyone. I mean, look, if you're not ready to be a parent, maybe it's not a good idea to be one. But the idea of saying happier, I mean, I don't know. For me personally, I can say as someone who lived through both, I don't even think I knew what happiness was.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it and to end our discussion here. David, it was a real pleasure to have you on. The show is part of The Problem. Do you want to – we'll put links in the show notes page. This is BobMurphyShow.com/13. Any final thoughts, Dave, for the listeners?
No, man, I'm so happy that you started doing a podcast. I love them. I've listened to every episode, and I think you're really great at it. I think you should have started a long time ago. But I'm glad that you're doing this, and I always love having you on my show. It was a real honor to be on.
Thanks, Dave. Well, because I was working on my material in the coffee shop before I got up. I didn't want to bomb, you know, episode one.
There you go.
Yeah, crickets. Okay, thanks, Dave, so much. And again, congratulations. And we're just looking forward to seeing more of what you got in store for us. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks, Bob.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit BobMurphyShow.com.